Hey, it's Mark. So, most of our episodes are recorded at the Crosscut Festival, which happened earlier this year. But we've been recording more episodes this fall. We've got two more conversations lined up, and we'd like you to join us. On October 24th, we're gathering a panel of experts to discuss how to mitigate and adapt to climate change. Then on November 19th, we're going to look back on the WTO protests of 1999 with the people who were there at the center of the action. For more information about these events, go to crosscut.com/events. Okay, on with the show. Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. Grassroots activism has always served a crucial role in American culture and politics. And getting out in the streets and marching and protest is still a valuable tool. But there are a lot of other ways activists spread the word and affect change these days, from social media campaigns to guerrilla marketing. Crosscut asked hashtag feminism founder Tara Conley to lead a conversation with three other activists about the tools and strategies they use to advocate for their causes. Amelia Bono is the founding director of Shout Your Abortion, a movement that aims to change the conversation around abortion in this country. She serves on the board of directors of the Abortion Care Network and has been honored by Planned Parenthood affiliates in many states. Kristen Rowe Finkbeiner is the co-founder and executive director of Moms Rising, a grassroots organization that tackles a range of issues affecting women and families. She is also a writer and radio host and the author of two books, including Keep Marching, How Every Woman Can Take Action and Change Our World. Earthfeather Sovereign is a member of the Colville Confederated Tribes and founder of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Washington. She helped initiate a Washington state bill that creates a more comprehensive database to track missing Native women, as well as a bill that creates a Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Task Force. Tara Conley is an assistant professor in the School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University in New Jersey. In addition to launching the website #feminism in 2013, she's published research on viral activism and produced interactive media projects, including Brackish, a documentary about Hurricane Katrina. She moderated the discussion. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and Waldron. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
All right. Good morning, everyone. I said good morning, everyone. All right. It is early, and I'm coming from New York, so I think it's very early for me. I want to thank you all for being here, and I want to thank the panel for being here. It's not often that I get to be in a room with people to just talk about some important work around social justice. I'm currently an assistant professor at Montclair State, so when I'm in rooms with big rooms with people, I'm usually talking to students, and at times it can be a one-way conversation. So I want to ground this space right now to say this is a conversation. I want us to kind of think and marinate on some of these issues. Some of the stuff that we're going to talk about might make you uncomfortable, and that's good. And so before I start, I think it's important to note that we all have different orientations to this work. I think for me, it's social justice work. It's an easier kind of way to think about it. So in order to get into those orientations, I want to talk about kind of the story of how we got to be where we are. And I'll start with mine very quickly. I was talking earlier about kind of how I got into the work of media making and thinking about the role of media and citizenship in whatever form that takes. And for me, it started with Hurricane Katrina back in 2005. I was younger than I am now. I'll just say that. And when the folks from New Orleans were displaced to Houston, at the time it was the Reliance Center. That was in my backyard. And I felt compelled to go down to the Reliance Center and volunteer and just talk with people. But in doing that, I also brought a camera with me, because what I was seeing on the news and what I was seeing in Google search results when I would type Hurricane Katrina, it bothered me, because the stories of the folks who were being displaced were not being told. And so I went down and I talked with folks. And so that experience, it ended up leading to a visual ethnography over 10 years following Hurricane Katrina survivors from 2005 to 2015. So I stayed with them to learn about how they transitioned from New Orleans to Houston. But that led to kind of my desire to do this kind of citizen journalism thing, which I'm not a journalist. But then it turned into a desire to document stories. Documenting stories, whether it be through video camera, whether it be through hashtags. So I enter this space as kind of a media maker, storyteller, but also an archivist. I'm obsessed and I'm paranoid about Black people's stories and making sure that they are memorialized in some respect, because I don't want our histories to be erased. So with that, I want to open it up to the panel. And I want to start with you, Amelia. Can you talk to us about your story coming into this space?
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you, Crosscut, for having us. Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here early on a Saturday. So I found myself in a situation in 2014 that I think anybody in this room who can get pregnant has maybe imagined might happen to them someday, where I was pregnant and I knew immediately that I did not want to be, and that I did not want to have a child. And I sort of took a deep breath and I just knew I was going to be okay, which is not really like the reaction we're told you have when you realize you're about to have an abortion. And that feeling that I was going to be okay, I chalk up to the fact that I live about 6 blocks away, and I had been going to that Planned Parenthood on Madison Avenue for probably more than 10 years at that point. And the folks there had always taken incredible care of me. So I knew that I had access to really good care. I knew that I could afford it. I knew that there weren't any like institutional or logistical barriers facing me, the kinds that exist at this point all over the country, such as 48-hour waiting periods meant to force people to spend more money trying to get to a clinic that's very far away and then maybe not be able to afford to go back. I knew that I just felt really okay with having an abortion, just on the deepest levels, and that I actually just, like, you know, I was happy to be able to make a choice to opt out of pregnancy and live my best life. So I went, and I also knew that I was surrounded by pro-choice folks, like that my friends and family and my core support were okay with abortion. So I knew that I was going to be able to talk about it if I wanted to. So then I went and had my abortion, and it was just an incredibly positive experience. I felt super well cared for by the people in that clinic. I felt so grateful that they were there, working there. And I honestly felt like I was like, you know, people have been helping each other end pregnancies since the beginning of time. And I was like, whoa, this is some ancient, like, women helping women stuff. I am so happy to be benefiting from this. So I had my abortion. About a year later was when Planned Parenthood was under attack after some anti-choice terrorists had made some videos making it look like Planned Parenthood was selling fetal tissue on the black market, which is not true. But the videos were incredibly damaging, and the House of Representatives sprung into action trying to defund Planned Parenthood for the first of now many subsequent times. And I was outraged. And like Tara, you just said, you know, that you just realized your stories weren't being told. I felt like no one was telling abortion stories, even though, like, abortion, the topic, was dominating the media, and, like, the anti-choice movement, because of that silence, had been able to turn this into, like, some horror film level campy nonsense. And I did not hear anyone out there saying, you know what, I had an abortion and it was fine. So one day it was the day that the House voted to defund Planned Parenthood. I went on Facebook, I wrote a status update that said, a year ago at Planned Parenthood, I had an abortion. I'm not ashamed, I'm not sorry. And I'm telling you this today because I think that the anti-choice movement is relying on silence from pro-choice women who have had abortions. And I hit post, and then I was like, ooh. And then I sent a screenshot of my post to my dear friend, Lindy West, who's an incredible feminist writer with a big platform. Lindy put that on Twitter, added the hashtag #ShoutYourAbortion and her own abortion disclosure. And the status update pretty much immediately started going viral. And hundreds of thousands of people use this hashtag to talk about their own abortion experiences on all social media platforms, every kind of experience you can imagine, and many people speaking for the first time. So that was almost 4 years ago. And subsequently, Shout Your Abortion has turned into a fully legit organization and really a full-blown movement, and we work to create places for people to talk about their abortion experiences in art and media and real life all over the country. Yeah, hope that wasn't too long.
No, that was great. Thank you so much. Just go right down the line. Kristen, can you share us your story?
It's so hard because life, when it's going well, I think is a series of wake-up calls where you blink and you look and you have a different perspective and you say, oh my goodness, how could I have missed this for so long? So the moment that I missed that put me in this seat here today that was a wake-up call moment was when I had my son, who's now 22, and he was born with a primary immune deficiency. And so I had been planning to work and to stay in the labor force. I was raised by a mom who was primarily single and always brought me up saying, you will bring in your own paycheck and never have to rely on anybody for food on the table or a roof over your head. And so I had a moment where I had a child with an unplanned health emergency, and I had to leave the labor force. There was no question at all, because he couldn't be with other children. They would get him sick. It meant a hospital trip when he got a cold. And I didn't have any access to paid family medical leave, like only 12% of people in the United States of America do today. So it was an unplanned departure from the labor force where I lost my job-linked health care, and I lost, obviously, my pay. But I had a partner who could keep the roof over our head and could keep us being able to eat and who had job-linked health care. So I looked around and I said, whoa, that was a close call. If this had happened to my own mother, it would have been an outright disaster, which would have possibly been very hard to recover from. And in fact, 1 in 5 children in the United States of America today are living in households with food scarcity due to family economic limitations. So this disaster is happening all over our country. So what I did in that moment is I came out of actually working in politics, environmental politics. I picked up the phone call like any normal person would do. I called the US Census and I said, how many women are there out there like me? Because of course you call the US Census when you have a struggle. And they said, we don't know. We are not tracking unremunerated labor, moms, or anything like that that's happening in the United States of America. This is invisible. And so this for me was that moment, one of those moments, and a series of many moments of wake-up calls, and I have them every day, including today, probably 500 of them, where I already said, whoa, I wish I knew that before that 1 second ago. But, you know, I had a moment where I said, wow, what is going on? So I started looking even deeper. I found that 82% of women in America have children by the time they're 44 years old. I found that being a mom and being a mom of color is a greater predictor of wage and hiring discrimination than being a woman is. I found that we are behind most other countries when it comes to family economic security policies, policies like paid family medical leave, affordable child care, which costs more than college, policies like access to health care, excuse me. I found that we have a giant, 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 enormous amount of work to do. And I found that having a baby in the United States of America, while mothers are seem to be worshipped, while mothers are seem to be put on a pedestal, is in fact one of the fastest trains to poverty in our country. And so I wrote about it. I started writing articles for newspapers and magazines, and then I wrote a book called The F Word, Feminism in Jeopardy. I was annoyed. And then, together with Joan Blades, who is the co-founder of Also Move On, we started Moms Rising. We started with a handful of people, just a handful of people. And through mom telling mom, woman telling woman, we are now over a million people strong. We are in every state in the nation, and we are fighting to increase family economic security, to decrease discrimination, and to build a country where everyone can thrive. Because we know one thing is clear. We know that gender justice, racial justice, and economic justice are absolutely intertwined, and one cannot happen without the others. And we know that when we look at the policies, when we look at the impacts on our lives, when we take those moments to open our eyes and look around and say, oh, I wish I knew that 5 minutes ago, that the racism, the sexism, the discrimination that is happening in our country has happened since the founding, is hitting all of us, some of us harder than others, in ways that are profoundly problematic. And we found something else that's important. We found that when this many people are having the same types of problems at the same time, we don't have an epidemic of personal failings, as many of these issues are often framed. Instead, we have national structural issues that we can solve together. We can break down these barriers together, and we can build a country where everyone can thrive. So today, I'm here with you in this chair due to a series of wake-up calls, a series of enormous mistakes, a series of moments where I go, whoa, I wish I knew that 5 minutes ago. And I hope that I learn every day for the rest of my time on this planet that I'm blessed to be here. And I thank you for learning with me. So in closing, people say, why do I care about this? So I will ask you, everyone who is a mom, could you raise your hand? Now, everyone who has ever had a mom, could you please raise your hand? So hello, you are in our movement. Anyone with a belly button can be involved. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. That was good. Earth Feather.
I would like to stand up and say something right now. Part of the work that I do is encouraging everybody that anytime they hold an event or even a meeting, that they recognize the indigenous people of the land which they reside on and which they occupy. And also helping to uplift the most oppressed, suppressed, and marginalized group, which is the indigenous people. So with that, I would like to raise my hands to the Duwamish Nation, in which land we stand on and which we occupy.
Thank you.
My name is Earth Feather Sovereign. I'm a member of the Colville Confederated Tribes. My mother is Deanna Marcelli. My father is Ernest Clark. I am a descendant of chiefs and one of our last matriarchs, Quipitza. I get asked this question a lot, and how did I come to do the work I do today? And I'm an advocate today for our missing and murdered indigenous women and girls and people, which also includes our Two Spirits, which is the LGBTQ plus nation, and also our missing men. Where I begin, I would say, before I even came to this physical realm, I chose to be here. People talk about intergenerational trauma, but I believe that I have intergenerational wisdom. I come from a line of people who were leaders and advocates. We come from a matriarchal society. When people think of matriarchy, they may think of patriarchy, where patriarchy is more about power and control. In matriarchy, it's about nurturing. It's about thinking about your nation and your people as a whole. So that is the reason why I do this work, not only to help uplift my indigenous people, but to help uplift all people. are missing and murdered Indigenous women. We have been experiencing this since time immemorial. It didn't just begin with our colonialism, because when some people may think of colonialism, they may think about Christopher Columbus. Christopher Columbus came here in search of gold. He didn't find it, but what he did find were beautiful people. And in his thought process, he thought that, well, sex trafficking them and selling them as slaves is worth its weight in gold. So he is known today as one of the first sex traffickers here in America. And that's why we want to abolish Columbus Day and instead celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day to continue to uplift our people and to heal our people with the intergenerational trauma. But colonialism began in Europe. And not only were our Indigenous people matriarchal societies, but even your people were matriarchal at one time. So getting in touch with your Indigenous roots and where you come from is part of that healing process, because we were all primitive at one time or another. We all lived off the land. We all lived off our Mother Earth. And that's where the healing is. But today, our people suffer. Women experience 10 times more domestic violence and sexual abuse than non-Indigenous people. 1 in 2 will experience sexual assault. 3 out of 4 will experience domestic violence. Between the ages of 10 and 34, homicide is the leading cause of death. But our missing people, it's not just us. The NCIC, they said that we have over 600,000 missing people in the United States. The highest number is almost at 3,300,000, and that's men. And about 320,000 are women. And of those numbers, today, our Indigenous people here in Washington State only make up 1.8% of our community, and this is why our numbers are so high. So 5,712 are our missing women. 8,177 are our missing children. And there's no comprehensive database. So part of what I do is legislation. Last year we passed a Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Bill, HB 2951, which directs the state patrol to do an inquiry within Washington State with the tribes and urban organizations. And this year we passed HB 1713, which created 2 liaisons to strengthen government-to-government relationships and to also make protocols when interacting with Indigenous people and what the police can do, certain steps, when someone is reporting missing, because there's too many stereotypes out there that some people just put our cases on the back burner. Well, part of that is I'm encouraging people to put Indigenous people first. Part of that is the racial equity and putting our cases first and tackling our issues first. Because once you did do that and help us fix our broken systems, this will help you and your people fix your systems, not only with our missing people, but with healthcare. So thank you. I'm honored to be here today. Limlet.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, every one of you, for sharing your story. And what I'm hearing is kind of a theme that runs throughout is this notion of remembering. Remembering our voice, remembering our mothers, remembering our land, remembering who we are in the chaos, especially with this work that we do, which implicates policy. It implicates our souls. And I think maybe we forget about that too. So thank you all for reminding me to remember. So with that, the name of this, the title of this panel is Activism That Works. And oftentimes, especially now in this kind of 280 character soundbite space that we live in, we tend to just throw out these words and forget that there's stories behind them, forget that there's policy work to be done, forget that there's organizing work to be done. So I want to just kind of tease out, pick apart this notion of activism. I don't consider myself an activist. I don't think I ever have. I need to figure that out, why that's the case. So I want to start with this conversation, and I want us to be honest, too. I want us to think about, for example, when it comes to organizing and going up against systems that seem incredibly, incredibly big and not and resistant to what we want to do. How do you characterize the work that you do? If it is activism, can you talk about it? If it's not, what is it? Can I start with you, Earthfeather?
Well, the word activism, I don't believe I'm an activist. You know, the word activism, well, even the English, American English, you know, language is not my language. Our indigenous language, it's one of the most descriptive languages. It's poetic in some terms. You know, I wouldn't say, she stands up for abortion rights. And then just hearing that, the word abortion, you know, people might think, oh, well, you know, she stands up for, you know, killing babies or something like that. But it's much more than that. She stands up for women taking power and control, you know, over their own bodies. So, you know, just using one terminology as activism, I think we need to change the language in everything that we do. Like, I usually tell people, you know, I'm an advocate. Even like during Standing Rock, people try to portray what they were doing up there as protesting. Even then, they changed the language, saying, no, we are not protesting, we are protecting.
Right.
So, you know, you could even form your own terminology in what you do, because I believe that the word activism also marginalizes what we do as people. When we do so many things, just putting us in one category minimizes everything that we do. So,
thank you. I can't wait. Y'all are making me remember this stuff. I appreciate you. Woo! Amelia.
I think that I really appreciate that framing. What immediately jumped out to me as you were talking about sort of like the word activist makes it sound like you're an outlier, right? And that you're like pushing for a radical agenda that is somehow like beyond what most people need or want. And, you know, it's like, you're just asking for water. Mm-hmm. I'm just asking for my body. Mm-hmm. And I refuse to believe that it's somehow radical for me to say, I had an abortion, I'm cool with it, And I'm going to talk about that openly because I'm allowed to talk about my life on my own terms. You know, we live in a country where one in four people who can get pregnant has an abortion at some point. And, you know, abortion has been legal for almost 50 years. And when people look at me and act like I'm being, you know, out of pocket by just speaking openly about my life, but the people who want to, like, force pregnant women to cremate their miscarried and aborted fetuses are somehow reasonable. Like, I'm being rude, but they're normal. I reject that, you know? I do call myself an activist, I guess, because it's like the easiest answer to give somebody that makes sense. But I also think that it's kind of a weirdly, like, individualistic framing for what is truly, like, collective work, you know? And I guess the last thing that I would say is just, you know, culture change and, like, bringing awareness to the stories that are so often untold is a form of activism, obviously. And I guess, you know, for, like, people who have had abortions, like, just telling your story in public does, like, push people around you to, like, a place of greater compassion than they might have had before. If they're just able to look at the people they know and be like, oh, wow, I know a bunch of people who have had abortions. You know, the antis are, like, getting away with making us think that we don't know those folks, but we absolutely do. And so I think that just, like, being who you are is, you know, when you look at the world and see that it's not set up for people like you and you decide to be yourself anyway, that is, like, culture change in its most sort of granular form. So, yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
This is a hard one. It's complicated, and I'm so thankful to be able to listen to both of your answers. And I was thinking, if I had to define what I was, I would say I was a believer. And what does that mean? Like, to unpack that. That means that I believe in the power of people to create a space, a community, a state, a country that reflects all of our contributions and all of our needs. And I truly believe that can happen. And as part of that, I think part of the problem with the word activism, and you mentioned this quite well, is it's so narrow, you know? And creating what we need to create is not narrow. It's beautiful, it's diverse, it's glorious, and it does truly represent all of what we are and all of our contributions. Activism also sounds like not a listener. And I think that to be a believer, we have to listen as much as possible to what's going on around us and then be in service to opening avenues to make the fastest possible changes to break down those structural barriers that all of us are facing in multiple different ways. Some of us are facing in compounded ways more than others. So why do I wake up every morning and be a believer? I started organizing when I was 19 years old, and I just turned 50 this year. And I hope I have many more years. My grandma, who's 104, she keeps calling me and saying, Kristen, I hope you're not tired yet, because you gotta keep going. And then she says, you know, the crumb is still in office. That's Donald Trump, by the way. My 104-year-old grandma has named Donald Trump the crumb, and it's my favorite nickname for him ever. I call him the malignant Cheeto, but, you know. So we got that going for us. So the thing about activism is it also feels like a beginning, middle, and end. And I just want to close with this point right here, is that I feel like being a believer, being a participator, is about breathing. We breathe our whole lives. We breathe in listening, and we breathe out opening avenues to make a difference. And when democracy is going well, which it is not right now, it's not about one Oval Office, one crumb or malignant Cheeto, one election, one policy, or one moment in time. It's about every day making participation possible and being a participant. It's about everyday listening. And so through that, you have power to help inspire other people to make change. And through that, we see actual wins, like what you mentioned with passing policy in the state legislature. And I've been honored to be a part of many wins, both at the state and federal level. And that starts with believing that the win can happen and believing in our power, your power, the power of people in this room, and the power of people all across the state and country can make that change possible. So there's my answer. Thank you for your answers.
I would also like to add that even like in politics, they use the word progressive. Mm-hmm. You know, our Indigenous people, a lot of the things that they're progressing, we're actually regressing, you know, uplifting our women. You know, we were matriarchal societies. A lot of the things that we stand up for are human rights, our inherent rights. You know, we all have the right to drinking clean water, eating, you know, good food, breathing clean air. You know, we all have the right to walk around without feeling like, you know, we're going to be stolen or murdered. So a lot of the things that we talk about and the way we frame things is very important.
Yes, so I'm hearing we are radical, we are believers, we are protectors by just the very fact that we are. So that's, I'm taking away from that conversation. Before we get to the Q&A, I want to ask one more question. Kristen, you mentioned this idea of winning and what's a win. And I want to kind of reframe that idea. The question that I want you all to answer or address, what does liberation look like in where you are? And how can we meet you there? I will start with Kristen.
That is a truly large question. First, I want to just note that we live in a culture of rampant cynicism, where it's even hard to think about what liberation looks like, much less to think about what the first step of winning looks like. And so I do want to share just briefly that I have been honored to see so many people-powered wins, and that often they don't take one day, they take many years. So for example, I worked with many, 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 many other people and organizations for over a decade on getting paid family medical leave right here in Washington State. And now, starting next year, hundreds of thousands of people will have access to paid family leave for the first time. I also worked on that at the federal level, and now for the first time ever, we're gonna have an actual hearing in the US House next week, and a Moms Rising member is testifying. We worked on healthcare, the Affordable Care Act, and over 600,000 people raised their voices in just the couple months leading up from our organization alone to the final vote to help pass it. But importantly, it's had to face repeal more than 50 times. And when we had the House leadership, Republican leadership, the Senate Republican leadership, and the malignant Cheeto in the Oval Office all trying to repeal it, it was the power of real people that held the line for 30 million people not losing their health care coverage. Most recently, we had an incredible win that I didn't think would happen. So here's me. I've been working for, you know, 30 years. And sometimes, you know, I'm still surprised that we can win because we live in this culture of rampant cynicism, you know, and I'm like, whoa, we won? We went up against, actually, this is kind of, see, I can't even talk about it yet. I'm like, whoa, we actually won that? So sometimes we do corporate change work. We don't just do legislative change work. When we're looking at change, we're looking at legislative change at the city, state, and federal level. We're looking at corporate change, and we're looking at cultural change, right, on all these fronts. And that means we're not just active online. We're active on the ground. We're active everywhere. So in the corporate change level, we just got Wells Fargo and JP Morgan Chase to divest from CoreCivic and Geo Group, who are the largest for-profit prison industries in our nation and who are also funding the detention and separation of children and families. That's a huge win. That's a huge win. And so we can use all of our power, our political power, our consumer power, and all of that to make massive changes on all those fronts. You know, we could do it online on Twitter. We could do it in the state legislature. We could do it with corporations. So what does liberation look like? Liberation looks like breathing that every day, listening to people, and moving toward a country that is truly liberation experience for everyone. That means, most importantly, I do not get to define liberation. That means I get to listen. That means when I listen, that is when I move. And so that, I think, is the most important thing. No single person gets to define liberation, but we act in community with one another to liberate one another and take those steps every day. Not just that one liberation step, that one moment, which I wish could happen, but that everyday step for our whole lives, for our children's lives, and for their children's lives to move our country and our communities forward. So that is my answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
So you might be aware that abortion rights are not in a great place right now. We currently have 6 states with only one remaining clinic and over 90% of counties with none. And so in spite of the fact that abortion has been legal for almost 50 years, abortion access is not a reality for millions of people now. And it's, I want to be aspirational and I want to, I mean, not that what you were just saying is not realistic. I want to be not cynical, but the reality is that access is going to continue to be chipped away at either at a state level or if they overturn Roe under this administration for the foreseeable future. So that's all bad. But when I think about what liberation looks like, I think about reproductive justice, which is a theory that was and a term that was coined by Black activist women who were looking at like the white pro-choice movement, which was really like advocating for this concept of choice. And they were really like framing it as like, oh, Roe versus Wade happened, so we're good now. And Black women were like, well, we're not good. You're not talking about our lives and our concerns. We can't have children without being called welfare moms. We can't have children that we're feel safe about them walking around in the street without getting shot by cops. We need to be like advocating for women to and people to have babies if they want to, not have babies if they don't want to, and have those babies be safe. And so that it's this whole human rights framework that is not limited to just like this idea of choice, which feels to me also like a consumer term or something, like Pepsi versus Coke, you know, abortion versus forced birth. So, okay, when I think about liberation, I think about the fact that abortion access as it's set up is like a class-based privilege. It's something you have to buy from the doctor. And because of the Hyde Amendment, which happened right after Roe versus Wade, people have never been able in many states to use Medicaid to pay for their abortions. So access has always been a totally racialized class privilege. And that's gotta go. And one of the ways that that's going to go, that I think is going to happen in conjunction with like access being reduced in medical contexts, as we're seeing as abortion clinics go away, is people are going to start self-managing their abortions. And when I say that, I mean buying pills illegally on the internet and having abortions themselves outside of a medical context and outside of federal regulation. And we need to start learning to hold space for those conversations and helping people find knowledge about how to end their own pregnancies, because that's a reality, is that like people got to do what they got to do and have been doing that forever, you know? So I guess that's what liberation looks like to me, is like being okay without relying on institutions that have ultimately failed us all at this point.
Thank you. And Earth Father, I want you to answer this question too, but I have a part B to that. Cindy Gross, so in the context of what liberation looks like, what are some practical ways that we can follow the lead of Indigenous women to address climate change?
Well, when I think of liberation, I think of pre-colonization. I think of when we were able to, you know, have those inherent rights, those human rights of, you know, clean air, clean water, being able to live off the land, you know, there was really no concept of time. Being able to love and care for each other, not to worry about domestic violence or sexual assault, you know, being able to walk around, you know, free from harm. But today, that may look at like, you know, just trying to have no fear, trying to step up and have courage. And the way people could help with that is, you know, showing solidarity. Being brave and having the courage, you know, to step in front of a person of color in between them and law enforcement. You know, confronting racism. You know, our white allies could say no, you know, you don't talk to them that way. You know, like I said earlier, being able to help uplift our indigenous people by recognizing them, you know, when you hold meetings and hold space. And not to define how the indigenous movement is by your own terms, but by their terms, and being able to sit back and listen. As for our environment, you know, I believe everything is connected, even though, you know, she has her space and she has her space in what she does. It's all connected. And I think that our environment and our women are closely connected because, you know, our women were the life givers. And, you know, we are water, and we used to give birth by the water. And we had a covenant with God on the crater saying that we are going to protect this land. We are going to protect our Mother Earth. And in doing that, we'll protect all people. So being able to stand up and even talk to your legislations about and know who your politicians are, and even recognizing the laws of different jurisdictions, is empowering.
Thank you. Thank you. We have time for one more question. Can you believe it? And so I'll just open this up to the panel here from Anonymous. Do you, for anyone who wants to answer, do you ever come across call out or cancel culture in your work? How do you approach it? And how do we hold each other accountable and make room for growth?
It's a minefield. We've only got 4 minutes left.
That's it. That's it.
The cancel culture question. I think that, so, I mean, obviously this panel is about digital activism. And, you know, obviously the internet is an incredible tool for, like, raising awareness for issues and, like, spreading the, like, just like signal boosting. But I also think that, like, really we gotta learn to talk to each other in real life again. And I'm not talking about talking to Trump supporters, by the way, because I'm not trying to do that personally. But I think that in terms of, like, finding common ground, you good? I'm talking about within our movements, if you have a problem with somebody, why don't you hit them up and, like, before you try to drag them on the internet? I think that it's just in the best interest of, like, building our team. You know, the other side is, like, literally, like, half Nazis and half, like, Zionist Jews that have managed to get on the same page because they know how to pursue power in a totally absolute way. And meanwhile, our side just can't stop dragging each other to pieces online for really what are very niche disagreements. And I just think we gotta, like, learn to talk to each other in real life again. You know?
All right. I heard that. Anyone else wanna take that question on?
Yes, I agree. It's finding that common ground, being able to uplift each other, trying to stay positive, you know, even changing, like, again, the terminology and the way we view and see people, and more inspiring and uplifting, more of a community way of thinking and being.
I would just say that it's important, again, to listen. I'm into this listening thing. If you're called out, take a deep breath, you know? Don't fire back immediately. Think about what's going on in your life and understand that we live in a culture that is surrounded by implicit bias. Sexism, racism, all of that is part of our country. And so if you're called out, and I have been called out, then take a moment and talk with your implicit bias. Like, I kind of think about my implicit bias hanging out on my shoulders, you know, like, hey, what's going on here? You know, how have I been a part of this, and how can I be part of the solution? And then usually I'm thankful for the person who called me out. They took the time, they had the energy, they had the motivation to say, hello, course correction. You know, and when I started today with you all, I talked about a series of wake-up calls. Hopefully our country, including each and every one of us, is in a series of wake-up calls. And sometimes I take somebody else calling us. Hey, you know, can you wake up a little bit? You know, it's like, yes, yes, please. Yes, I would like to wake up a little bit more. So I it can be positive and it can be negative, but on the whole, I am thankful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And I think I'll just leave with this. In the midst of trying to get everybody else on the same page, I think we have to make sure we're right with ourselves and taking care of ourselves and protecting ourselves. I'm a good moderator because we are on time. All right, so I want to pause for 30 seconds and just give my gratitude to each and every one of you on this stage for teaching me something in the short amount of time that we had and allowing me to sit with you and listen. And I want to thank you all for being here, asking your questions, being respectful, thank you. And to the lurkers and the folks whose minds are thinking, I want to thank you for being here. And I hope that you can take what you've gained here out into the world and to just make it a better place. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And remember to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.